Good morning and welcome to the February 1, 2021 virtual meeting of the Chelan Public Utilities Commission. All five commissioners are present and I believe in the boardroom in person are our general manager, Steve Wright, clerk of the board, Rebecca Garvine, and counsel, Eric Walquist. If there's a I don't believe anybody else needs to be announced. So due to the coronavirus, we are meeting remotely, and while normally I would remind people to silence their cell phones, today I ask that you try to remember to remain on mute during the meeting unless you are speaking on a subject matter. We value public input at our meetings and will be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session and at the end of our afternoon session. If you wish to speak to any specific item on the agenda, when we get down to the approval of the agenda, I will ask for that input at that time. But we are, our meetings are recorded, so when you do ask for that permission, I would ask that you provide your name and address for the record. At the beginning now, our flag salute and safety minute will be brought to us today by Ryan Baker.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America.
Good morning, commissioners. Hey, this is Ryan Baker. Can you hear me okay?
We can now.
Fantastic. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity this morning. I'm here to talk to you about the HPI minute. This particular HPI minute happened last year in the district in our Parks Department, and unfortunately this started with an incident at Riverwalk Park. I'd like to talk a little bit about that incident and what we did after that. This started on one of our days working on the south shore at Riverwalk Park, where we had a parks employee operating a hedge trimmer. The employee was working on a very steep hillside where they slipped and fell, in which one of their fingers came in contact with the blade of the hedge trimmer. We did need to seek medical attention for this event, and I distinctly remember when talking with the doctor, they mentioned had the employee not been wearing the appropriate PPE, they likely could have lost one of their fingers. And in this case, he was wearing leather gloves, which stopped the trimmer from spinning. The employee was doing great right now, is back to work, having no issues. But I really want to talk about what happened after this incident in our department. Immediately after, I used the stop work authority that we have here at the district for the first time. I was very impressed that I was supported by my supervisors and folks that worked in the field. This gave us the opportunity to review our processes and what we might be able to do differently. After that, we had several safety meetings, not just in the Chelan area, but our other three locations where we discussed this incident. Out of those safety meetings, I was surprised to see that five other locations were submitted to safety concerns. And we didn't stop just at the hedge trimmer. We talked about mowing and other things that we do and working amongst the public. Staff was able to mitigate one of those sites by eliminating mowing on a steep hillside. And the other locations are being run through our normal intake process where we will look at, of course, budgeting, design, and implementation to fix these areas, not just for our staff, but the general public. But what I was really impressed about in working through this whole process is knowing that safety is one of our values and knowing that I was going to be supported by, you know, bringing some of these projects forward, because they're not, some of these projects might not be cheap to be able to mitigate. But again, I've been entirely supported by management and our own staff. And with that, I want to thank you folks for supporting human performance. It's really nice to know when something like this comes up that you can bring something forward and get resolution to something that, you know, is unsafe. I can think of many times, not at the PUD, but in other careers where I might have been asked to just get back out there and get the job done. Here at the PUD, we have that ability to stop work and to really look at what matters and protect our employees. So very, very appreciative to work for the PUD and have safety as one of our values. So I'll pause there and see if there's any questions.
It's a good, timely safety report for as we hopefully get out of winter and all of us start doing our spring cleanup. That was impressive. Thank you. Any other comments for Ryan? Well, thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Commission. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you. So the next item on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. But before we get to that, I just wanted to give you a little update about what we might be looking at down the road. As all of us realize, tomorrow is Groundhog Day. And I have it on good authority that Punxsutawney Phil will probably be buried under so much snow tomorrow that there's no way he could see his shadow. And so I think we're in for a mild rest of the winter. So anyway, for what it's worth, that's today's Groundhog Report. Next item on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. And I'd like to do two things here. One is if there's any member of the public that wishes to speak to any of the items on our agenda for this morning that is present and wishes to let us know at this time, we would appreciate that. Hearing no input, I'd like to suggest to the commission that we take a look at adding agenda item 11 to the consent agenda. Has been recommended by our staff. Is there any disagreement with that? Hearing none, the agenda will stand approved by consent from the commissioners. There was no objection. Item 3, quarterly electrical load growth. Steve.
Okay, this is, as we do every quarter, an update on what's going on with our local loads. Andy Wendell and Chad Russman will be giving this report. Andy, will you be starting today?
Sure. Okay. Good morning, commissioners. Thanks for your time today. Why we're here, we're here to give the update for the quarterly load forecast. We'll be giving a brief overview of some of the more active projects, customer projects, that we are currently working on. And then the primary time in the presentation would be Chad Risman giving an update on the active construction of multiple substations in our service territory. No action requested today. This is for your information only. I do want to note, commissioners, that we did move the schedule for the quarterly load update to coincide with being able to bring forward actuals for you. So you may have noticed a slight hedge in our presentation schedule, but that was purposely so we could bring you more actuals and information forward. System load observations moving into 2020 overall, the load aligned this last year with our historical trends. And our industrial loads were relatively steady and consistent with historical trends as well. The commercial loads, however, they were steady. However, there was a slight decrease in energy consumption in our commercial sectors over the previous years. We think there's a few reasons for that, but one obvious is with COVID, some of our commercial customers, such as hotels and restaurants and schools and, you know, other areas that occupy large groups of people, obviously saw a decrease in usage and thus a decrease in energy consumption. With that said, the residential loads were steady with a slight increase over the previous year, and that's I think it's due to some growth in the residential sectors, but also a lot of people working and going to school from home. This slide should look familiar. It's a 10-year load forecast changes. It's net of energy conservation. And we always like to put a few previous forecasts on there. We see the base case, a high case, and a low case. And you can see in January of 2021, we've actually reduced our base forecast down about just about 2.5 megawatts to 23.5 megawatts. That reduction is also represented in our high case as well as our low case as well. Those reductions from the load forecast theme are primarily associated with the recognition that we're seeing a decrease in loads associated with new cryptocurrency or high-density loads. That is a derivative of policies and rates and price signals that are being sent to that sector of energy users. And we think that those price signals are helping us minimize those high-risk applicants, some of those transient loads. So that is the bulk of the reason why you're seeing a reduction in our long-term forecast there. New construction observations moving into 2020, steady construction and planning for new residential homes and developments. There's quite a bit going on in the residential sector, both small and large developments. We'll take a quick look at some of those. Cryptocurrency loads remain consistent with our existing customers in 2020, but we have had no new applications. As you know, the value of Bitcoin had recently increased upwards north of 40,000 $40,000. However, the inquiries that we did see for a couple of weeks did not translate into new applications, and again, that's part of those price signals that we're seeing. New construction in commercial and industrial sectors, they remain consistent in line with our historical trends, as well as new construction that's found throughout Chelan County. It's not limited to just here in Wenatchee. It is in Chelan, Leavenworth, Cashmere. All the communities are seeing it, particularly in the residential sector. This next slide shows active projects of note that we've received since December of 2020. Now, the list is pretty small, and we do have a much larger list of projects that we're working on of applications that are in various stages throughout the earlier months of 2020. But some of the new ones that have come in, you'll see here, there's a 48-unit apartment complex up there in Cashmere, and a rather large development planned, very similar to Riverside 9 at the base of 9th Street here and adjacent to the Chelan County PUD Parks. There's a 406-unit apartment complex that's going through the permitting process at this point in time. It is two phases, so we anticipate it being built out over a number of years. But as you can see, it translates into about 2 megawatts of residential load at peak. And a few other developments in Malaga and Chelan with a total peak demand of about 2.5 megawatts for new residential growth just for those applications. This view seems to be pretty popular. It shows several developments in the Wenatchee area. I think with some of the new developments we have coming in, we could update this and even show more. But it does demonstrate a lot of new residential growth throughout the Wenatchee and the Old Station and Sunny Slope area. And so that's driving the need to meet a peak demand and thus more substation capacity. And that's where our Chad Risman comes into play.
Good morning, Commissioners. We got several substation projects, as Andy mentioned, there in construction and in design. First one here is Holly Street Substation, which will be a direct service substation providing capacity to the Diamond Foundry. And see back in October to January, some finishing touches put in place, including the fence. It's been that way in the January photo since, and still is today. We're waiting for one of the key pieces of equipment to finish off the station, which is supposed to arrive in the next couple of weeks. So we're looking forward to that. Balanced scorecard has this station being energized in Q2. We're looking at the June timeframe and hopefully transferring over the Diamond Foundry shortly thereafter, maybe the July timeframe. Next slide, please. Right on its heels is the OMI substation out there, an old station just below OMI. You can see the OMI gardens up there and in the trees above it. So the station is just behind. We've received all but one piece of equipment, ironically the same piece of equipment that we're waiting for, the Holly Street substation. It's scheduled to arrive March 15th. So energizing and commissioning this station will just come on the heels of the Holly Street station and expect to be energized in Q3, the latter part of Q3. Next slide. So I mentioned the things going on currently at Holly Street, a photograph of that, waiting on final delivery of equipment. Going to begin on Holly Street substation, doing the commissioning and transitioning from Milt and Schmidt Electric construction over to Schlamp UD. OMI, like I said, is following shortly behind that. Then in design, we've got North Shore, Chelan, Leavenworth, and Wenatchee are in the design phases. North Shore and Leavenworth, probably most notably, those are the next two on the list. They're starting outreach and civil design throughout this summer. We'll be doing outreach specifically on North Shore and this month. And then to follow in Leavenworth, one thing to point out on the Leavenworth substation there, that the corner of North Road and Chumstick Highway is where the property is, the station is slated for, has been identified as being one end of the potential trail, so there's public power benefit dollars potentially, looking at designing into the station lot there some trail-like features. So upcoming coming attraction on that. And then Wenatchee, through design, fall of this this year. And then start looking at the photograph or the illustration that Andy had up there, all the growth in the kind of northwestern part of Wenatchee there. We're going to be looking at identifying a site and evaluating a site this summer. We're working on retooling some of our project management structure and program structure. We'd like to speed up the substation construction and design and run some things concurrently. So over the next month, we're going to be rolling out a new project team restructuring, be able to run some, putting more emphasis on consultant design and delivery so that we can run some of these phases in the substation concurrently. I think that's it. Any questions?
Yeah, I had one back when Andrew was presenting. There was a slide with all the active development projects, and there was one, okay, right there. And Anadacom 455 residential lots. What is that? Where exactly is that?
Yeah, that is an application that the applicant is working through the city of Wenatchee on. We were invited to that conversation. It's essentially a multifamily housing development with some mixed retail in that. It actually is the Columbia Coal Store property.
Okay. That makes sense then. I didn't have it on that slide. I couldn't figure out where it was. Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions? Thank you. Good update, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, commissioners, next up, we want to get to a legislative update. Tracy Yunt and Sean Seaman will be presenting this.
So very good, commissioners. This is Sean Seaman here today. Today is just an update. Here we are into the completed almost the first month, not quite. So there'll be no decisions today. We're just going to give you an overview of what's been going on and what to expect for the rest of the session. So next slide, please. So just an update on the committee assignments. We didn't have these last time we spoke, but you can see here, these are pretty much the same committee assignments as last year for Senator Hawkins and Representative Steele and Representative Gaynor. What was interesting, the number of bills was anticipated to be lower, and we are seeing that. There's as of the 28th of January, there were 794 bills, and the bill introductions have slowed down greatly. And I just noticed, I was looking at my list of bills and the piles of bills, and what was interesting, I hadn't seen this trend before, that most of the bills that we're tracking this year are coming out of the House as opposed to the Senate. It's just an observation. I can't tell you why. But I thought it was an interesting and probably somewhere in the order of 3-1 in the number of bills that I'm tracking anyway. So far, the virtual session has been pretty workable with some challenges. I think some of the biggest challenge is the sheer number of participants in hearings these days. Now that you can do it virtually, they're seeing, in some cases, 1,000 testifiers sign up. And in some cases, 1,000 people sign in just to support or oppose a bill. But the point is there's more, in some cases, on the more interesting or challenging bills of interest, too many people are signing up to testify than they can get through. So that means we're looking for different ways to how do we get our input into these bills, whether it be through written testimony that we can provide or letters or reaching out to legislators. So it has definitely changed how we do business in Olympia, obviously. Other also of interest was that the proclamations that we have been tracking over the last since March, the ones we've been tracking closely related to ratepayer protection, eviction notices for landlords, we've been watching as well, but for public records and public meetings, all those proclamations have been extended, I don't want to say indefinitely, but until the end of the, by the legislature, until the end of the pandemic or legislative action, so we don't know when those will end at this point. They're more open-ended than I've seen in the past.
Sean, may I ask a question, please?
Yes, Commissioner.
It's just a point of clarification, and it's back to the committee assignments. I see that Senator Hawkins, okay, no, I just answered my own question. Thank you.
Glad I could help, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And the last thing before we move on to the next slide is that I'm happy to announce that the first cutoff date is coming up in 2 weeks, February 15th. This is when policy bills have to be out of their committee of origin, and that is usually the first significant date to where we are able to reduce the number of bills that we're tracking. But so far, a number of the bills we have been working are making their way through the process. So next slide, please. We talked about some committee changes initially, and we have a little more information on those. The House Innovation Technology Committee, this is where the telecom issues in the House used to reside. They're now in the Community and Economic Development Committee, chaired by Cindy Rue. She's a Democrat out of Shoreline. Also within the House, the Rural Development, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Committee is now chaired by Representative Chapman out of Port Angeles, which is good. It's a PUD community, PUD area. And then the Senator Patty Pritter out of Bellevue is chairing the Senate Housing and Local Government Committee, and where we have the local government committees where we see a number of the bills that we've been concerned of in the past that will now come through per committee. Next slide, please. These are the same priorities we talked about previously, the Dryden wastewater funding. The capital fund request is what we have submitted it. Thank you to Ingrid Miller for her work getting this done. And it was submitted with a sponsorship, or primary sponsor on this is Representative Steele, and Representative Gaynor is a co-sponsor. And this is about $1 million request come through the capital budget to help supplement the Dryden wastewater project. The grant program request, which was to the Department of Ecology, has we're on the list, and tentative awarding of that is around $2.5 million. And so with the $1 million capital fund request and the grant program request, that should cover the construction costs if we are successful in getting those both of those ultimately. So we'll be providing support for those, both those funding program requests throughout the legislative session. The Clean Energy Fund, there's we're supporting this program. There's possibilities for some VAR programs we'd like to see, including the water-filled turbines. And so there are some potential funding mechanisms through that request, so that avenue of funding. And so we'll be continuing to support the amount of money. I think there's about, it escapes me now, I think it's $10 or $40 million that is in that the current budget, and I can circle back to you on that dollar amount. I just have to go back and check that out. So next slide, please. Now digging into what's happening on the energy issues and reining parts of the legislation. The carbon pricing alternatives, we talked about the cap and invest. This is a Senator Carlisle bill. It's a governor request legislation. PGP is tracking this one carefully from a standpoint of how it would work, how would it work with our markets. There's another component of this related to environmental justice, but my review of the bill is that this will not impact the PUDs directly, utilities directly. It'll come through other avenues. As you recall, the current bill that we're working under for the Clean Energy Transformation Act has quite a bit of work for utilities related to our customers, and I'm not seeing that in this as far as customer touch points. It's going to come through other mechanisms. The carbon tax bill, we did see an introduction of that just recently. This is Bill 5373. And now this is interesting because it could be a direct competition for a cap and invest bill. This would actually be a fee on carbon. I don't have a lot of details on that yet, so we'll be able to report on that later, and you'll probably get an update on that as it becomes clearer as the reviews take place through the Waputa meeting coming up in a couple of weeks. But what's interesting is that how's that going to play out now, the carbon tax versus the cap and invest? And during the cap and invest hearing, there was quite a bit of discussion about other groups to support the carbon tax, particularly the environmental and social justice groups were not in favor of the cap and invest bill and were supporting this yet-to-be-seen carbon tax bill. So that could create quite a chasm between the governor, what he wants to see, and what some of the more progressive members of the Democratic caucus want to see. So stay tuned on that one. It should be very interesting to watch that move forward. 1091 is the low carbon fuel standard. It has moved out of committee, the policy committee. It's in the fiscal committee. There are still some aspects of this that the utilities have been tracking. We're staying neutral on this one so far. But some utilities are more engaged and are concerned about how any utility funding or utility revenues would be spent. They're pretty well, if a utility does receive funding on this, there are aspects of the bill that detail how those funds would be spent towards more electrification of transportation. The building decarbonization bills, 1084 and 5093, we talked briefly. These would basically try and eliminate the use of natural gas within the commercial and residential building sectors. And natural gas companies are obviously pushing back hard on these. But this is part of the state's goal towards their emission reductions out into the future. The community solar bill, we'll just touch on this. This was an effort last year. It was a completely different effort this year to change some community solar aspects in current law. This particular bill would only apply to the investor-owned utilities in a very narrow area of the law. And then just to touch on, make sure we continue to track the Senate Bill 5000. This is Senator Hawkins' bill to continue to support the efforts from 2020, I recall, to help with hydrogen generation by PUDs. And this would just give an outlet for the use of those in the hydrogen that might be developed by public utility districts. Next slide, please. telecom issues are going to continue to go, as we'll see these going forward. There's a heightened awareness, as I'm sure you're all aware, of the need for more broadband, particularly in unserved and underserved areas of the nation, including Washington State. We've seen a couple bills, 5110 is by Senator Erickson. It actually just doesn't change. It sort of works on authorities for PUDs. We haven't been supporting it. We feel that the change it was requesting wasn't really a step forward for PUDs. It would basically allow utilities to combine their systems. If you had a telecom system, you could combine your books, so to speak, with your electric system, as opposed to keeping them separate. 1336, this is the bill we've heard about that would provide retail authority for PUDs by Representative Hansen. For the most part, the PUD is supporting this bill. There's a couple of minor changes that we are seeking. There's a definition under wholesale, what wholesale authority would be, and we're concerned about that there's a drafting error, so we're actually working on getting that changed before executive session later this week. I'm still on this current slide, please. Are you booting me off? I guess that's the question. I'm still on telecom. Thank you very much. The broadband office funding, we did see the bill come forward from Senator Huntingford, and it would bring some new authority to the broadband office, as well as provide $200 million for funding for serving unserved areas in the state. The poll attachment bill, we did see that drop finally. That's Bill 1440. And this one it's basically a bill to streamline installation of small wireless infrastructure. So it is, call it the 5G bill again, but it would definitely take away a lot of the authorities and protections we have, not just PUDs, but municipalities as well, to try and get more small cell wireless infrastructure out there by taking away a lot of the protections we currently have. I have not seen anything on digital equity, and at this point in time, I doubt we will, just because the policy cutoff is coming up. Next slide, please. Human resources safety, the two bills that are related to paid family medical leave, both of those do about the same thing that we're concerned about. They change the definition of family member such that it broadens that so that more residents would be able to apply for and qualify under the paid family medical leave. So we are currently working with others on that definition to see if we could get some amended language to that. The other two bills, 1076, workplace violations, we've seen this before. It's about whistleblower protections. And it just sort of expands who can help and who can file cases regarding whistleblower protections. And finally, worker protections, 1097 is related to the COVID-19 pandemic and whistle protections for workers related to workplace protections for COVID-19. Next slide, please. Other issues is 55,007. This is the Waputa bill to seek relief for utilities related to their assistance programs for COVID-19. That seems to be having some problems in getting a committee hearing and hasn't been scheduled as yet. 5158 was the Wildfire Advisory Committee. This is an outgrowth of the Wildfire Task Force from a 2019 legislation where utilities would work with the Department of Natural Resources. And this would codify that task force and turn it into an advisory committee and also seek the work of that task force continues. So this is a bill we've been supporting. Steve Wright testified on this, as did other GMs, PUD general managers, and it is now out of committee and into it's moving forward, so we're glad to see that. There's a couple bills related to public meetings during emergencies. I won't get too deep into these, but these would either require during emergencies to have virtual meetings, and one bill actually would require that commission meetings, which were decisions are being made, would be allowed. We could be virtual going forward as a rule as opposed to just during emergencies. So definitely tracking these public meeting bills carefully. The net ecological gain requirement for public projects, this is a bill that this is probably taking most of my time, would require a net ecological gain for public projects. So this is only for public projects, whereas public private projects would only have to meet a no net loss criteria that's currently in statute. But public projects such as ours, and could be our substations that you just heard about, could undergo and have a higher requirement to. And I apologize, I have to log back in for a second to make sure I know where I am. But this bill, hold on a second, commissioners, I apologize for this delay. This bill would require that public utilities, others would have to achieve higher standard than just replacing a no net loss. We'd have to make sure that we do extra work, environmental work, towards salmon recovery goals. And there's a lot more on this that we'll spend more time on in another date. I am having problems here. I apologize. I am still, there I am, I'm back. 1130, Representative Mary Dye bill. This one we don't think will go anywhere. This will require utilities to basically reduce our bills, our customer bills, by a certain percentage by a certain time, as well as meet higher level of reliability standards out into the future. 5168, this is a bill that is being supported by WAPUTA. This would, for programs under SFIDA, you could basically utility that was going to do certain actions, including Energy Transformation Acts, could get those pre-approved, if you would, by Commerce and Ecology, so they knew if they were going to put effort forward on a project, it would be qualify under SETA. Next slide, please. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things that came up over the weekend. I'll just hit these real quick. There has been another electrification of transportation bill, 1204, and these will be showing up in my This Week in Olympia update, so you'll have a chance to see those there. It's just going to seek a study to say, can the state meet electrification of transportation goals? Is there enough energy supply? One thing that's missing, though, is there enough distribution supply, system infrastructure. So there's some concerns being voiced by WAPUTA there. There's a 1368 is a bill that is actually going to appropriate funding that's coming out of federal funding. There's $325 million that's been earmarked, and this bill is on a fast track. They want to get this in place. This is how would we spend some of the federal money into the state. Again, $325 million has been earmarked for housing, rental, and utility assistance. But right now, the funding is going through housing authorities, and it's unclear how much of that money would go towards utility assistance, and how would those housing authority groups get that money, and how would they help disperse it for utility assistance. So we're working on that. WAPUTA's working on that issue. I think I will end it at that. I've taken enough of your time. Can I open any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Commissioner Smith, I have a question.
You bet.
And Sean, with respect to House Bill 1056 on public meetings. Do we have, what is the current extended date that public meetings being held virtual will have been approved through?
So it's right now it's open-ended, Commissioner. They've only put it to the end of the pandemic, when the COVID-19 pandemic ends, or as otherwise determined by the governor or legislature. So there hasn't been a date certain set yet.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Well, Sean, it looks like it's keeping you busy. Are you operating primarily out of your home office on this session?
I am, and it seems to be working fairly well. What I do miss is the ability to find people and ask them a question in the hall about a bill.
I bet.
You don't know if they're ignoring my phone call or they truly are busy. So.
you can't horse collar them this way.
Yeah. No, I cannot.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for the update. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Back to you, Steve.
Is Sorry, I get disconnected for just a second. So next up, we want to talk about Rock Island relicensing. Recall that in the district performance plan, we indicated that this year would be a significant ramp up in activity around Rock Island relicensing. I want to give you an overview of the schedule, and so you get a sense of the key activities that will be taking place this year. Janelle Ulrich will be presenting.
Good morning, Commissioner. Janelle Ulrich, Hydro Licensing Manager. As Steve mentioned, I'm here to provide an update on Rock Island relicensing. Next slide, Rebecca. Specifically, I'd like to brief you on our ongoing work that happened last year and is occurring this year. I want to share an outreach presentation that we've put together for our external stakeholders. It's a template, and it will be modified as needed for various and sundry stakeholders, but it provides schedule and other important information about relicensing and the project. I'd like to describe a proposed resolution and give you a little heads up here. I'll be back in 2 weeks, so I'd like to introduce to you today a resolution to support the relicensing process. And finally, I'd like to answer any questions that you may have about this year and relicensing. Next slide. So with ongoing work, we are really focused on planning right now, which makes a lot of sense. We've put together a document that articulates the governance and advisory roles for the vast internal staff, which touches a lot of our organization, as well as our external stakeholders, which vary quite a bit, describing their roles and responsibilities. This is a draft document, and we understand it'll change as things roll and as we learn more, but for now, it helps with clarity around roles and responsibilities. We've had offers accepted from two talented individuals who will be joining us on February 22nd to round out our relicensing team. I'll remind you that we've chosen to strategically keep our teams fairly streamlined and fairly small. We'll be utilizing people from all over the organization, but the dedicated team will primarily be comprised of these individuals and Michelle Smith and me. We've been developing an economic model. This model is designed to tend and write into the district's financial model, but it allows us the ability to run various scenarios for different outcomes, both if we want to test different ideas and things that we may agree to, as well as to look at risks and probabilities of things to occur so that we can keep an eye on what it looks like for the overall system. We've been putting information management tools in place to efficiently and effectively support consultation with external stakeholders. A big part of relicensing really is making sure that you're reaching out and collecting input and responding to that input. So we have to have all of our minutes and all of our agendas and all every comment we have to receive and collect. We have to respond to every comment that we receive. We have to make sure that everyone has access to documentation, that they know where meetings are and how to attend. So it's a pretty big list. And if we get good information management tools in place, we can save a lot of staff time and money, and we can also ensure that we've got a robust process and we can look for any gaps and make sure that our consultation is thorough. We've also been collecting in one place in an organized way the vast background information that we have on this project with respect to all the various resources that the district supports. Next slide, please. And this vast background basically sets the stage for getting into relicensing. A lot of relicensing, the first portion of it, really is conducting studies that are looking for, we look for gaps and we try to fill those gaps with studies. So we're doing a pretty thorough evaluation of what studies we expect. It helps us with forecasting and it helps us to understand the overall issues. And of course, thanks to your approval, we've begun early action projects. The two that we're working on pretty actively right now is a feasibility study in the Horan Natural Area with the Audubon Society, so that's trails, et cetera, any small modifications in that Horan Natural Area, as well as the Chelan County is working towards having a 30% design on a potential Malaga Park by November of this year. So we're highly participatory in that effort as well. We're collecting some really important background information and setting up a platform, a GIS or global positioning information system that has all of our topography So we're going to do a flight and collect what's called LIDAR data that actually can penetrate into part of the water and get near shoreline during one of our drawdowns. And we're also going to take a boat out in the water and collect bathymetry data with a sounding device so that we actually know what the bottom of the river looks like. The technology has changed so much since we did Rocky Reef. Mind-boggling. But these data are really important because they help us to identify habitat and its quantity and quality, as well as they can help us understand river flows for a potential Malaga Park or other places, which can be really important when you're trying to site different things on the river. We are going to need a lot of consultants. We're going to conduct a lot of studies, and these studies are incredibly diverse, and it's very important that we get the absolute best consultants to the table, the best resources we can. So we're working to look at who those consultants might be and trying to make sure that the procurement process is well planned and organized, because we don't want to drive our procurement staff into the ground. And finally, we're really working on outreach. So we're planning on starting outreach here in the next month or so, and we're going to move through that for the next 6 months. So it's a pretty big effort to make sure that everybody at different levels in different areas of interest has been engaged. And so with that, I want to start on the next slide showing you this presentation. And again, it's a template. It'll be modified, but it provides just an overview of Rock Island relicensing to begin the conversation. And we'll start this with the agencies and tribes who have regulatory authority associated to the relicensing process, and then extend it into the community at large as we move forward. So this is the cover slide, and anything that's got the dark blue on the top is really this external presentation for other folks that I wanted to use to share with you today. So next slide. So we start out by describing a bit about who we are. Depending on who they are, they may know a lot, but you know, our businesses, our size, and where we live. Next slide, please. And then the discussion largely is going to share what relicensing is, what the habitat conservation plan is. It's going to give background licensing facts for Rock Island. It's going to describe the three FERC relicensing processes and our overall anticipated schedule for Rock Island relicensing. It provides contact information, and then it dives into discussions and questions, because we want to have plenty of two-way dialogue with each of our people or each of our different agencies and organizations on our preliminary outreach to them. Next slide, please. So the way we're describing Rock Island relicensing, or relicensing at large, is the idea that when you first construct and operate a project, you get authorized for a project license that can last up to 50 years. When that license expires, you have to go get a new license called a relicense. And that new relicense authorizes the continued operation of an already existing license or project. And that term now is allowed to be 30 to 50 years. The default is 40 years. It used to be 30 years. We can feel proud that we helped change that default to 40 years with early action, as I know you're familiar. In addition to flood control, dam safety, power generation, cultural resources from inundation, and other public uses of the waterway, the Federal Power Act requires FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to ensure that licenses are really robust. And I'm going to read this because I know there's people on the phone who don't have access to this slide, and I think it's really important that we give equal consideration to the purposes of energy conservation, the protection, mitigation of damage to, and enhancement of fish and wildlife, including related spawning ground and habitat, the protection of recreational opportunity, and the preservation of other aspects of environmental quality. So that is our bar. What's in those quotes, in addition to flood control, dam safety, power generation, that is our bar. And that's a real good place to start and to know what's expected. Next slide, please. With respect to the process, at least 5, but no more than 5.5 years before our license expires, the owner's required to put together a notice of intent called an NOI and a pre-application document, which we often refer to as a PAD. So you'll hear NOI and PAD. Those are really just a notice of intent and a pre-application document. They need to be submitted to FERC, telling FERC that we intend to seek a new license so they know it's coming. That said, initial relicensing coordination with stakeholders very, very frequently begins prior to the formal relicensing process. And for a project as big as Rock Island on a river system as relevant as the Columbia, efforts usually start 7 to 10 years prior to the expiration of a license, so well before that. And you'll see when I share our schedule in a minute that indeed that's our intention. Next slide. We're sharing what our Habitat Conservation or HCP plan is, and reminding folks that it's unique and that it protects and enhances salmon and steelhead returns on the Upper Columbia and the tributary, that it has three pieces that make up no net impact, the 91% of survival through the project, plus the 7%, up to 7% compensation for hatcheries, and a 2% compensation that helps with tributary habitat program. And we're reminding people or informing people that it goes above and beyond what's required, and it's very adaptive, and it includes a no surprises element to it, that it's consensus-based decision making. This is consistent with our culture, and that we use best available science. That's who we are. That the Rock Island Dam project should become invisible to fish when we do our jobs well. And as such, power operations gets more uncertainty, and we end up with careful resource management to support clean, renewable, and carbon-free power. So when we talk about the planned fish you see in the second bullet, next slide, please. We are talking about, and this is what goes above and beyond, not only the endangered spring chinook and the threatened steelhead, but also three species that aren't listed under the Endangered Species Act, sockeye, summer and fall chinook, and coho. And pointing out and reminding folks that for all of these species, we have met no net impact in those three areas. And once we're done with that, next slide, please. We're going to move into these licensing facts. It's being the first project in the Columbia, there's a big history here, and it's real important to remind people that this history is here, and it is extremely relevant to what we do next. The first license lasted from 1930 to 1980, but it actually extended for an additional 9 years on annual licenses. In 1986, there was a new regulation brought forward that actually introduced what I showed you in quotes before, which made the licensing process far more robust than it was prior to that. So I think the timing, in a way, Rock Island was kind of caught in the crosshairs of that, which turned out to be a good thing because we ended up having robust environmental consultation and good information put into the license that we received in 1989. That's a 40-year license, so it expires at the end of 2028. In the middle of that, though, in 2004, the license got amended, and we introduced the HCP. So you'll notice from the chart above, the HCP has a 50-year term from 2004 to 2054, and we anticipate receiving a new license, a 50-year license, for Rock Island at the beginning of 2029 that would extend to 2079. So those are the kind of overall background dates. I will remind you that this is the third license. And that's an important thing that we recognize with our stakeholders, because what it means is that the Rock Island project is locally adapted, and it contains already in the existing license vast protection, mitigation, and enhancement measures that protect the resources. So even continuing the license that we have today is going to provide a lot of value to all of those resource areas. Next slide. That said, we can't lose sight of project economics. So we've included this project economics slide that depicts a conservative look at the straight value of energy versus our overall cost. And it reveals the financial pressures that are associated with our future obligations of rehabilitating powerhouses 1 and 2, modernizing the spillway, conducting seismic retrograding, and the overall ongoing operations and maintenance of the project. We're invested in this project being a sustainable project for the most, for the best, for the longest. And we need to be really mindful of the fragility of the economics of this process as we move through Rock Island relicensing, and be open about sharing that with our stakeholders. Next slide. Okay, this is a busy slide. I'm not expecting you to read this. This is a chart from the FERC website, And it shows the three potential relicensing processes that are available to relicense or obtain a license for a hydro project under FERC. The oldest is the traditional process. This process is paper and utility driven. It's very seldom used anymore for large projects. It's a bit antiquated, I guess might be a way of putting it. Also listed here is an alternative licensing process. That process is utility driven and it's extraordinarily collaborative. This is the process that we used. I'm having Sean's problem where my computer falls asleep. This is the process that we used for Rocky Reach and Lake Chelan. And it's very consistent in a lot of ways with our culture. The final process that's shared up here is called the integrated process. This is FERC's default process. It's a new process that, it didn't exist when we relicensed Rocky Reach and Lake Chelan. It is driven by FERC, and it has hard deadlines in it. So there can be pros and cons to these different approaches. Next slide, please. So if we don't make an official request for a process, then FERC will default us to the integrated licensing process. If we want to, we can request a different, what are the other two processes be used? And FERC must approve it. It's not something you can just get. FERC has to decide if they want to allow a licensee to use a different process other than the integrated licensing process. And the things that they consider when they make that decision is the complexity of the resource issues. If there's anticipated controversy, meaning the different federal and state agencies and tribes, local stakeholders, and or the utility aren't going to agree on things. How much background information there really is? Do you know everything you need to know? Are there big unknowns hanging out there? Is there a potential for big disputes over studies or studies and the interpretation of studies? And they also care what the various and sundry stakeholders think. Which process do people want to use given a given utility in a specific project? So if we decide that we want to use an alternative licensing process, for example, we'll need to make a proposal and substantiate our decision based on these five bullets you see before you. And FERC ultimately will make a decision whether or not they'll allow that. Next slide, please. All right, here's our schedule. A lot on this slide, but it's a pretty important slide. So you can see in the 2020 timeframe that we're in the beginning of this year, we're really ramping up. We're really putting all that background information that I described before. We're right on schedule. We're doing really well, and we're beginning our external outreach process. We have the hard deadlines I mentioned before of submitting that NOI and PAD in the second half of 2013, and then the National Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA, scoping process takes off from there. We have to submit our draft license application at the end of 2025 and our final at the end of 2026. So we built our schedule in classic project management style, working backwards, knowing what we needed to do, and that ends up with our starting our technical working group meeting, and this is getting everybody at the table to talk about which studies should be conducted and how should they be conducted, and then launching into those studies this September. What's really nice about this schedule is that we don't need to make a commitment to our relicensing process, whether we want to use an ALP, alternative, ILP, integrated, for example, until we submit that NOI and PAD. So it gives some time to work with our stakeholders and learn a lot about if we've got controversy, if we have issues that are unresolved. And so we don't have to make a decision until that point, and we'll collect a lot of information between here and there. And we won't commit because we need to do the right thing for this project and the organization and the strategy at large, working with our stakeholders. Overall, our intention is to be highly transparent and collaborative and to have that be the case with all of the parties with whom we're working. Next slide, please. So in this external outreach presentation, we share that we will be making a formal request to our stakeholders to provide us any additional information after we give them the background information. If there's anything they think is missing, we want to know about it. We also want to know what issues they care about and what studies they think should be done. So we'll collect all of that over the summer and learn from them anything that might look like a gap so that when we all meet in September, will be prepared to hit the ground running. We're going to set up different levels of engagement that are true for us as well as all of our other stakeholder parties, an executive level, a policy level, and then your technical level. So we'll be getting a formal response on who they want the contact to be for each of these different levels. And this gives us an ability to work issues on a parallel path and make sure that people at all different levels are in tune and lockstep together. And again, that's all with the intention of starting technical working groups in September of this year. Next slide. We wind this up by providing our contact information for both me and Aline as the HTP manager. But you'll notice there's a general email that IT set up for us called Rock Island RI Relicensing at Chelan CUD. That's for time resiliency. I'm not planning on going anywhere, but that email can be used through time on this long process. So anybody can get a hold of the Rock Island Relicensing team at any point. That's being done on a lot of other projects. Next slide. And then we'll, again, have that opportunity for thoughts and questions. And I'd like to, prior to describing to you the resolution that I'll be back to speak in 2 weeks, I'd like to use this time right now to ask any questions or comments on the information we've presented so far.
Hi, Janelle, this is Ann Congdon.
Hi.
Great job as usual. Would you just take us back to slide 13? I just have a question about that graph. There we go. Okay, so Rock Island cost, mid-sea flat pricing, just deficit. Help me with that graph again, if you would.
Okay, so absolutely. I appreciate your asking that question. This is just a conservative view of energy costs only. So it does not include carbon. It does not include capacity. What it, the blue line, the Rock Island costs, are the mill rate costs that do include encroachment. And then that mid-sea flat pricing is just that energy cost that we expect for the value of energy for mid-sea. And then the red line being the difference between the two. And, of course, we have some hedging in place, and we have hopes for carbon and capacity, which, of course, the reliance on them over a 50-year look is to be determined. But this shows that from a very conservative perspective, we have tight financials at Rock Island, and we need to be mindful of our spending.
Okay, yeah. I didn't pick up that the red line was the difference between the two. I see at the bottom deficit from mid-sea flat pricing. All right. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate your
terrific
help.
Question. Thank you. Yeah. Other questions before I talk about the resolution?
Janelle, this is Randy, Commissioner Smith. When the license process starts, is it an open process? Can there be competition?
There can be competition, but the reality is it's an extremely rare thing for FERC to take a project away from a licensee who's successfully delivering on a project. So there's very, very, very low risk that anyone would ever be able to remove Rock Island from our clutches, if you will, because we are very, very successful at operating and maintaining the project from every perspective that FERC cares about, from dam safety to the environment, et cetera. So that it's incredibly improbable.
Okay, thank you.
Janelle, this is Gary. And I'd like to go back to on your slide where you were talking about collecting and management of spatial data, topography of the reservoir. Are you collecting data just in the vicinity around the dams, or will you be collecting data in the entire reservoir?
Yeah, this is actually exciting. So I could be a little nerdy, so I'm going to warn you. But when we did Rocky Reach, we went and grabbed cross-sect data. So we went every mile. So we had 40 cross-sectional data points. And you kind of have to guess, like, if there's deep pockets between them or shoreline that's shallow, because it was incredibly cost prohibitive. The technology didn't exist. But these days, you literally drive a boat down the length of the reservoir and back, and it puts a multi-spectrum sonar down into the water, and it bounces it off the bottom, and it brings back a picture of what the bottom looks like. But it gets really expensive to try to collect that data in the shoreline, because the amount of data to the size that you can collect is proportional to the depth. So when you get in the shoreline, you know, you drive the boat the whole way and you don't get very much. So I worked with a pretty remarkable team of folks. Actually, I ran into a guy I went to grad school with. It's such a small world. But we are going to be pulling the reservoir down to do some work with RTVista. And so I'm going to overlap and work with our energy resources group and use that opportunity when the reservoir is down. And we're going to fly a plane over the shoreline, and they use a green infrared band that can penetrate the water 5 to 10 feet. And so it was a pretty inexpensive flight, and combined with his boat, then they stitch all that data together in GIS and present it to us in our coordinates for our platform with a picture of how it works. And the folks that are flying overhead are the ones that had the contract for the Department of Natural Resources and collected all the shoreline stuff around. It just worked out that way. So we will have this one uniform picture of what the entire topography looks like, as though there weren't water there, the whole reservoir, quite inexpensively.
Wow, that's cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Can I jump in there? That's amazing. When you say quite inexpensively, what are we talking about? Not counting the aerial zoom work.
Okay, so even with the aerial, it's under $170,000 to collect all of that data, stitch it all together, and put it in our information management system. And
wow.
It can keep us from doing things like misstocking sturgeon, or we can understand more about what Pacific lamprey ammonites need in the shoreline. It can help us understand impacts of sedimentation. It can help us understand if the water is flowing at the appropriate level or too hard, where we might have a potential boat launch. We can do a lot with those data.
So what are the depth limits of the collecting the data with the boat technology?
That is a fabulous question. I don't know the answer to that question, because I don't think we got anywhere near them. The Columbia isn't terribly deep, and so that didn't come up, but I'll look into that and let you know, because I can find out quite easily.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you maybe offline, because we want to do that sort of thing on Lake Chelan. But we've talked about, you know, getting these little subs, maybe leasing a sub from the University of Washington that goes down so we can do the, you know, bathymetry of all the area under the lake level. So that, yeah, I'll contact you later. That'd be great to know. Thanks, Janelle.
You bet. Other questions before I share the resolution information? You're good, Rebecca. Okay, last slide. So I'll be back 2 weeks from tomorrow with a request that we can use the Kleinschmidt group to help us in a variety of ways. They are pulling together all of that background information into what we call an initial consultation document. So this is all of it's the high level of all the studies we've done, all of the things we know. They're pretty interesting documents. We have one for Rocky Reach. They'll also be supporting us with public outreach. They'll be helping us coordinate all the various and sundry meetings, remembering that we intentionally, strategically have a small team for relicensing compared to what others do. We did this on purpose, and it should work well. They're also going to be developing that notice of intent and PAD with and for us, supporting all of that information management I talked about, all the agendas and the meeting minutes, all that sort of thing, and all that data management. They relicense projects all over the country. They are relicensing experts. So they'll be there to provide us additional advice. We haven't done this in 20 years. They're also going to be conducting a good number of the studies themselves and subcontracting a good number of the studies. We've been very strategic to make sure that if we already work with a contractor and we really like them and they already know our project, we'll go ahead and hire them directly to do studies where that makes sense. But when we don't, our goal with all of the other work going on with the modernizations, et cetera, is to make sure that we don't overwhelm our procurement group. So they will be conducting some of the studies and subcontracting directly, which is the bulk of the dollars that are presented. They, in addition, are helping with the normal day-to-day routine licensing support for Rocky Reach, Lake Chelan, and Rock Island, while we're bringing a new software package in. It's a pretty big lift, and they're there to help us, so then we'll have good efficiency going forward. So they're helping with all of that right now on a high level, but this is to basically ask for funding for 3 years and a very concerted effort for $5.3 million. So it's a good chunk of the Rock Island relicensing budget. And we'll be back in 2 weeks to get more on that. Anything else?
I just want to say thank you, Janelle. That was a great presentation. Very clear, and I think all five of us commissioners understand that relicensing one of our projects is a really, really big deal. And it's I feel really good about you having a lead role in this. It's I think we're going the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, commissioners, so as Janelle mentioned, we will expect to see a resolution in 2 weeks that'll have an opportunity for you to act upon. Unlikely that we will make a presentation at that time, so and if you have questions, please let us know between now and then. I want to move next to a safety concern report. You may recall that after our fatality, we had an investigation that brought forward a set of recommendations. One of them was that we report to you regularly on safety concerns and how they are being exhibited in the district. Rhonda Wilkinson will be making this presentation.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Rhonda Wilkinson, Director of Safety and Human Performance. It's great to see all of you again. So this slide shows that the safety concerns that were submitted and completed between 2018 through 2020. So through, you know, training and retraining and encouraging our employees, you know, we continue to receive and increase the number of employee safety concerns submitted each year. So this first set of columns shows the total safety concerns submitted between 2018 and 2020. And even though we had more challenges in 2020, you know, with COVID and less in-person meetings with the crews, you know, we still had 108 submittals. The next set of columns is even more positive. It is the safety concerns that are submitted by district employees. And so these numbers do not include what was submitted by the safety department. So this shows that we continue to trend in the right direction with employee engagement. So the last set of columns are the safety concerns that have been completed over the 3 years. We've had 292 in total. So you may notice that this graph shows that there were more completed or closed out than were submitted over the 3 years. And this is because some of those completed safety concerns were originally submitted into the system prior to 2018. So currently, we have 72 that are open. 60 of those have been assigned engineering controls, and we are working through those. And then we also have another 12 that are in progress. So during my presentation, basically, I'd also like to address another item. In early 2020, Commissioner McKenna voiced a concern about the Lucas report that was presented to the board. Specifically, Commissioner McKenna, you had asked about the results of one of the six interview questions. It revealed that we had 11% of the 500 people interviewed did not understand when or how to submit a safety concern or a close call. So I'd like to briefly explain, you know, what we did and continue to do to educate the district on this process. In 2020, right after the survey was completed, we had multiple safety meetings that were held to discuss the safety concern close call process with the business unit personnel. And even recently in January, we had a safety meeting that we reviewed all of the safety concern data for 2020, as well as reinforced how to submit a close call or a safety concern. And so also keeping the safety concerns and the close calls in the forefront, our monthly safety meetings contain information on newly identified items as well as closed items. And then we also started a new process where every 6 months the safety department reviews all of the safety concerns in the systems that are taking longer to close due to the engineering controls. So these are reviewed with the business units and updates are then sent out. And then we also started a process for when safety concerns are closed, besides the auto-generated email that is sent to the BU leadership, we also email the employees who submitted the concern. Direct follow-up with the employees is important, we all know, to let them know that their safety concern was addressed. And it also allows the employees an opportunity to provide feedback. And if they still have any kind of concerns or they have questions on that closed item, they can get back to us on that. And then last, just to ensure that our safety concerns and our close call process is being understood by all district personnel, we will be asking Lucas to return this year, hopefully mid-year, depending on COVID, to complete a follow-up survey to compare where we're at today versus the previous survey. So that's what I have for my presentation. Commissioners, do you have any questions?
Yeah, Rhonda, this is Commissioner Bowles.
Yes.
And could you help define for me, please, engineering controls?
Well, typically it takes, the engineering controls are something, it's a little bit more of a robust system that we put in place. It's beyond just the minor fixes. So it usually takes a lot more money to incorporate time, money, resources, and so it typically takes past like a 45-day period is what we're looking at. So there's just a lot more involved in those fixes, and so just like I said, just to make sure that we continue to follow those up and make sure that those do get addressed and are focused on, we are doing those the follow-ups to make sure that they are continuing.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome,
Rhonda. Could you maybe give an example of an engineering control?
Well, it could just be a matter of, like, for, like, fall prevention is installing a fall prevention system. So that we would have to, make sure the engineering, assessment was done. And really, there's a whole process, I guess you can say, that makes sure that we're setting up a system that is within compliance and regulatory compliance. And so it takes just there's a lot of, a lot of steps to get those completed and getting the right in, the right people or the right companies involved in getting those set up. So, like I said, it usually, when I say that we had the 12 items that were in progress, that's usually within a 45-day period is usually when we get those taken care of. And so anything outside of that 45-day period would typically, the engineering controls part would fall into that that category. Any other questions?
Rhonda, Steve McKenna. Just thank you for the follow-up on the Lucas question. I had forgotten about that question, and it was a good reminder. And I'll look forward to seeing that the results from that next survey. It'll be interesting.
Oh, absolutely. You're very welcome. I think what I really liked about just reviewing the safety concerns that were submitted, It's nice that we have individuals or employees that are submitting all the way from just loose bolts that they found on a column all the way up to maybe confined space concerns, outlets that don't have a GFCI, we have fall prevention concerns. And so it's across the board, across multiple topics that the employees are turning in these safety concerns on. So it's great to see the involvement from the employees on the out of the field.
Okay, Rhonda, thank you very much for that presentation. I want to move on to our last presentation from this morning. I want to do two things here. First, the issue is one that we've talked about with the board some. There's a lot of discussion going on around the development of the Western markets, both the energy imbalance market and the potential for what's called an enhanced day-ahead market. And where we have paid particular attention is to the governance of those issues. And Tuli Hakala will be describing that. I believe this might be the first time Tuli has made a presentation to the board, so I want to take a moment to introduce her as well. She's been with us for a couple of years, really focused on wholesale markets and the potential opportunities and risks associated with the development of wholesale markets in the West. So with that, Thule, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. How's my audio before I get started?
Sounds good.
Great. Okay. Well, let's dive right in. Next slide, please. I'm going to cover a few topics today. I'm going to start with providing an overview of the Governance Review Committee. That's part of a key part of the regional governance discussions that are underway that Steve provided an intro into. We'll touch on the process that's being followed and the timeline briefly. I'll cover some of the key points from prior comments that we've filed in this stakeholder process. Touch on Northwest Public Power governance interests that we've developed working with some of our Northwest Public Power partners. And then at the end, I'll discuss an upcoming comment opportunity that we have this Wednesday and outline some of the key points from the comments that we anticipate filing on Wednesday. Okay, so the Governance Review Committee, so in order to look at improving Western EIM energy imbalance market governance and looking at what type of governance structure might work for an extended day-ahead market, also called EDAM, the California Independent System Operator assembled a stakeholder group. They're an advisory group, and they have essentially two purposes. The first is take a look at existing governance for the Western EIM and see if there are any opportunities now that the region's had several years of experience with the EIM, see if there's opportunities to improve it. And then second, importantly, take a look at governance and see if the region moves forward with an extended day ahead market, what would governance potentially look like for that type of market structure. Importantly, the Governance Review Committee is being asked to work within the confines of the existing statutory framework that CAISO exists under. And so for purposes of discussing EIM governance, EDAM governance, it's important to know that the CAISO, the California Independent System Operator, is a creature of California state law. Has obligations under that state law. The board is selected by the governor of California and confirmed by the Senate. And so the framework we're really discussing here is a delegated authority framework where under that framework of California law, what type of authority can the board delegate to another more regionally representative body? Next slide, please. So the Governance Review Committee process, which is being run by that stakeholder advisory group, it's been very iterative. They started out with a scoping paper, and now we are at a revised draft proposal phase. Stakeholders had a number of opportunities to provide comment. I think we're at a point now where stakeholder positions are becoming fairly clear, and we've really investigated that statutory framework I mentioned and have learned a lot more about, you know, what's the art of the possible within that framework. The next step that we're anticipating is based on this next round of stakeholder comments that Governance Review Committee will bring a draft final proposal to the EIM governing body and the CAISO board. And those two entities will jointly make a decision on it. If they approve it, it would move forward for implementation. Next slide. Let me provide a little overview of some of the comments that we've provided so far. One of the things that we've noted is that as a general matter, we think that further regionalizing and centralizing the markets in the West would be a good thing from an operational and reliability perspective. But it's important to understand that as you move along that continuum of further centralization, you also increase the risk significantly for market participants and the region as a whole. And so EDAM, the extended day ahead market, has a very different risk profile if you compare it to the Western energy imbalance market. One of the facts that we often hear is that for a particular utility, your energy imbalance market transactions may compose maybe 4 to 5% of your portfolio. But if you're looking at your day ahead transactions, that's probably more like 40%. So just from that trading perspective alone, you can see the increase in risk there. In our comments, we highlighted that the governance framework has to be sufficiently independent from California political interests. And so if we are working within this delegated authority framework, the regional body, which for EIM is the EIM governing body, needs to have sufficient autonomy from the board to be able to develop market rules, and that delegation of authority needs to be sufficiently durable. What would be concerning is if the CAISO board could come in and unilaterally either create a new market rule or revoke the authority of the governing body, or in some other way hinder the workings of the governing body by, for example, defunding them. Next slide, please. I mentioned that we worked with a lot of our North.
Oops. Tule, we lost you. Are you there? She is still connected. Think what? No. Tule, we're wondering if you might have bumped your mute button. We can't hear you at the moment. All right, we're going to call on.
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Oh, there, you came back. Excellent.
Okay. Steve, can you help me out? Where did I cut out?
I think you got through about your first bullet point on page 6.
Okay. Not too bad then. Okay. So I was just starting on the Northwest Public Power interest. Is that right?
Yes.
Great. Okay. So I described the purpose of these interests. They would signal what our kind of collective expectations were for an EDAM governance framework that would be acceptable. And the interests would guide in our evaluation of different proposals that are put forward. I'll highlight some of the key interests here. First is that independent board. So for EIM, that's the EIM governing body. Let's see, slide 6, perfect. The expectation is that regional body would have decision-making authority over rules that impact the EDAM footprint and that it's durable. And so the CAISO board wouldn't be able to come in unilaterally and eliminate that board, revoke its authority, defund it, or anything like that. And then a third-party dispute resolution was important to us. We anticipated that because we're dealing with that delegated authority framework, there's going to be some role for the CAISO board. And so if there's a disagreement between the CAISO board and that regional body, we want some kind of independent third-party resolution that would address, for example, disputes about market rules or even disputes about the governance framework itself. Let's move to slide 7. All right, so we have a revised straw proposal now. It's specifically designed to address the energy imbalance market. And right now, efforts to work on the EDAM, the extended day ahead market, have been paused. CAISO is focusing heavily on preparedness for summer of 2021. They want to avoid some of the really unfortunate experiences that happened last summer. And so there's a pause in EDAM. However, while the proposal we have in front of us is for EIM specifically, there's a sort of common understanding that it would lay the groundwork for what we would look at for an EDAM. And so it's while the, if you read the proposal, it may say it's limited to EIM, it's important to understand that really what we're talking about here is improving EIM, but also building a framework that should be looked at for EDAM as well. The main elements from that proposal that touch on those Northwest public power interests that I just mentioned are that there would be joint authority between the EIM governing body and the CAISO board. And so if there was a effort to change a market rule for the real-time market, for example, both of those entities would need to consider it and approve it for it to move forward. There is a third-party dispute resolution component to the proposal as well. If the governing body and the CAISO board disagreed over a market design dispute, then two alternative proposals would be filed with FERC, and then FERC would be asked to pick the better one. There's an important exception here. We learned from this governance discussion that there's a what we consider a significant limitation to the delegation of authority because of CAISO's statutory framework. What we've learned is the CAISO board needs to maintain a certain degree of control over market rules. And what they've shared with us is that if there's a scenario where the governing body wants to change a market rule, but the board is happy with the status quo, then the governing body is not able to move forward with a FERC filing. So in practice, one way to think about that is the CAISO board can veto market design improvements that the governing body would potentially be advancing. Another significant element of the proposal is that the CAISO board can unilaterally revoke the governing body's delegation. There is a notice period that's built in there to protect market participants, but this was one of the significant findings for us about the limits of that delegation. We had hoped to see something where the governing body's delegation could only be changed with the governing body's consent, but what we've heard from CAISO is that if they built that into the governance framework, it wouldn't be consistent with their corporate responsibilities, and so it's a no-go. Let's move to slide 8. We have an opportunity this Wednesday to provide comments on this revised straw proposal, and so I'm going to touch on some of the key points from the comments that we have drafted. We support the proposal for purposes of the energy imbalance market. We think it's an improvement over the status quo. That regional governing body, their scope of authority is expanded in a way that we support. However, we do not think that the governance framework laid out in the proposal would be acceptable for EDAM. We're concerned that, we knew going into this that we would probably learn some things about the limits of what the CAISO can do under their statutory obligations. We have a much better understanding of what those limits are. The two limits that we're the most concerned about is, one, what we've learned is the CAISO board has to retain the ability to unilaterally revoke that delegation of authority. We've also learned that the CAISO has to maintain final control over changes to market rules. We think that's likely acceptable for purposes of EIM because of that smaller risk profile I mentioned earlier. For EDAM, we don't find that acceptable. We think that because of these legal limitations, it's unclear whether there are solutions, legal solutions, that could bolster the governance framework for EDAM in a manner that we would think is acceptable. That will be the next step in the discussion if the EDAM effort picks up again after CAISO's had a moment to focus on their summer readiness, then we anticipate that there will be a continued conversation on EDAM governance. But we felt that this was the time for us to provide a strong voice in saying what we see here probably is not going to be acceptable for EDAM, and we have significant concerns that there are legal barriers that we just won't be able to overcome. I will pause there and happy to take any comments or questions.
I'd like to add a little bit of color and reinforce the comments that Thule has made. Going back a year ago when this process started, we expressed reservations about whether a board that is statutorily authorized to operate could delegate significant responsibilities, and hence whether, in fact, we could get to a point where market participants outside of California could have confidence that the decisions would not be subject to a California political process. But we concluded that the effort to go through this process and try to think through what is possible was worth participating in. There have been a couple of rounds of comments. Thule's been very active in this. We have endorsed the comments of our fellow public power entities, PPC and PGP, throughout that process. In this case, there are a lot of really good comments in PPC and PGP's comments, but there's one place where we are differing, or at least distinguishing our position, and that's whereas they raise questions about whether there are problems associated with what has turned up as a result of this CAISO General Counsel opinion that came out during the course of the process, our conclusion is that it reinforces something that we expected, which is it's very difficult, if not impossible, to create the kind of governance structure that can give that assurance that market participants outside of California will be treated fairly, especially under crisis conditions. That's not to say a lot of good things haven't happened. Some really good things have come out of this process that have reduced risk for extra California parties. But at least from our perspective, it would not be enough to be satisfactory to proceed with an EDAM, which would cover such a significant part of the market. Okay, I'm not seeing any comments or questions. If we're good, I would say, Thule, thank you very much for the presentation and for your good work on this all the way through for the last year.
Yeah, I would like to echo what Steve just said on the thank you. You provided great clarity today, and I know it's been a lot of work, and you presented it well. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Commissioners, we're done with our morning agenda. I would like to, because we have some time, move to a couple of our manager items so we can use our time wisely, if that's okay with you, Commissioner Smith.
Steve, absolutely.
Steve, may I jump in here? Sure. I've been trying to unmute. My unmute and mute button apparently isn't working very well.
Sure.
So I guess my question is with regard to the presentation and the EDAM, what are our next steps? Do we have next steps? Are we concluding with this?
Thule, you want to take that?
Sure. I don't think we've reached the conclusion here. So we'll have another straw proposal that we'll have an opportunity to comment on. But I expect that next straw proposal is going to be limited to EIM again. And so that will be another opportunity for us to address EIM, but still raise these same concerns for EDAM. It's a little tricky right now. If I had a crystal ball, I would really be happy, but it's hard to know exactly when the EDAM effort will launch again. We're hearing that, it could be later in the spring, it could be the summer. Best case scenario, though, we're still years out from that being implemented, and there are always informal discussions going on about, well, are there some other options? There seems to be a regional lean towards further coordination and some type of further expansion beyond just a regional EIM, and so I expect that those types of discussions will continue. They have been for the past couple of decades. And so I think we'll just keep engaging on this, on the CAISO effort for as long as we need to, and just be ready and open to participate in any other conversations that might materialize about other options. But Steve, please comment if you have anything else to add there.
Well, I just want to reinforce some of your earlier comments. Our comments will go on Wednesday. They're due along with all the other comments. And then the CAISO has officially announced that they are going to take a break on all activities that are not associated with getting ready for next summer after the blackouts last year. And so the EDAM process will basically be going on hold at least through August of this year. So there is an expectation, though, after that, that this will pick back up again. And so we'll have to see where it goes from there. And I just say Thule's comments about kind of monitoring the process and staying involved along the way as opportunities come up will be our next step.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Any other questions from commissioners? Steve, I think you can move to some manager items.
I'd like to do that. I want to take a moment. We're excited to welcome Ian Fitzgerald to our team. Ian is our new Chief Technology Officer. This is a significant move on our part to create a Chief Technology Officer position. Comes out of the board workshop from more than 2 years ago to identify innovation as an area that the board wanted the management to focus on. Ian comes to us with a great deal of experience. I'm going to let him take a moment to describe that to you. And I also would, after Ian has had a chance, he's had a chance to engage with him, I want to take a moment to thank Alex Smith, who's been in the acting position and has done just a marvelous job, really a terrific job from everyone I've talked to about this in terms of keeping things rolling over the course of the last 9 months. So, Ian, please take a moment and introduce yourself to the board.
Yeah, President Smith, members of the commission. I'm Ian Fitzgerald, and I want to really thank you and General Manager Steve Wright in giving me this opportunity to come to Chelan County PUD as the Chief Technology Officer and bring a lot of my expertise, my education, my knowledge within the electric utility industry, including water and fiber optics, and bringing technology really to improve the customer owners, the experience across the whole district, and provide a situational awareness that really helps with efficiencies with the operations of a district like Chelan County. My background a little bit, I've actually just completed my MBA last summer. I did it while I was working full time. It's my second master's degree. I have a master's degree also in technology information systems. And I'd recently been employed by a public utility district, much like Chelan County PUD, but over in Truckee, California, just north of Lake Tahoe. I've been there for about 20 years, implementing a lot of what Chelan County PUD is looking to do today. AMI, outage management systems, a customer engagement environment, and field mobile technology as well. So that's sort of a quick background, but I'm open to questions if any of you have them of me, or just like I said, thank you for this opportunity. It's really exciting. I'm super excited to actually be involved in this team and helping move forward.
Welcome aboard.
Appreciate that, President Smith.
We're looking forward to getting to know you in person someday.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Commissioners, a couple things I'd like to say about Ian. I think he brings a tremendous skill set. His experience is right on point with the types of things that we are trying to address. We also evaluate candidates for values as well, and we believe that he's brought a great set of values consistent with those that we articulate here at the district, and his background in public power certainly shows his commitment to serving customers. He displayed to us during the interview process a real desire to be great as a utility and as an individual, and we appreciate that focus on continuous improvement. And I'll just say after the first week, we've seen a lot of great things. So we're quite excited about what he's going to be able to add to us here at the district.
Thanks, Steve. Also, I just want to also say thanks to the commission and General Manager Steve Wright for providing a culture. that is amazing. I've already seen with the values, with the culture, you've got a lot of extremely talented, friendly, outgoing, helpful people in this district. It shows my first week, and that really is a testament to this commission and the general manager of moving that culture through the whole district and through these employees.
Would like to take a moment and turn to Alex. You know, I mentioned a moment ago that we actually didn't know that our CIO was going to retire until shortly before he made the announcement. And so then we needed to make a quick decision about where to go. Alex went through a competitive process to take on the acting position, and it turned out to be the successful candidate. And I think we have all felt good about that decision, because it's been a challenging time. These are big goals that we set in terms of trying to improve technology, development of our technology roadmaps at the same time as getting our customer information system operating so that it's actually producing bills and stabilized, and all of the other activities that go on that that generally, candidly, don't come before the board but are absolutely necessary to be able to keep things running smoothly. The fact of the matter is that we haven't had big issues that have come before the board, in part because of the great work that Alex has done in a very collaborative fashion. So, Alex, I personally want to say thank you for just the tremendous job that you've done, and we just really appreciate your stepping up and not only doing this job, but you get to do your existing job as well. So, great job on doing two jobs at once.
Thanks, and I appreciate it a lot, and I'll be really brief. I'm really excited to have Ian here. He's going to bring a lot of leadership to us as well, but with some understanding of things that, you know, are new to the district and really excited going forward. And I also wanted to mention really quick the overwhelming support that I've had from Kelly. She's done an amazing job supporting me personally and giving me a lot of leadership that I really needed in order to be successful in this job. And then on the secondary portion of that too, really in a challenging time, the rest of IT has also really stepped up. And knowing that we're going to be going through a transition, I think we're all really excited for this transition to have Ian on board and you know, to do great things here at the district. So I'm really excited to move forward and hand some of that stuff off to Ian, and I'm sure some of that he's going to hand back to me as well. So I'm excited going forward, though. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, welcome, Ian. This is Steve McKenna, Commissioner. Welcome to the organization. It's an organization that we really do value continuous learning and continuous improvement, so welcome. And Alex, thank you for your ongoing work. Thanks for stepping in and continuing that good work.
Thank you, Commissioner.
If there are no other comments from the board, I do want to take just one more moment and also say thank you to Kelly. So Kelly shepherded this process from the beginning. So we had that discussion about innovation going back a year ago, have really been trying to step forward with technology roadmaps. She put the contract in place with the consultant that helped us develop our first technology roadmaps and gave us at least the bones to be able to build the structure that we have been building ever since. And then put in place the contract to evaluate what it would take to accomplish the technology roadmaps with utility service partners that the board saw last year that led us to the conclusion to split IT off and create the chief technology officer position and the entire set of functions that go with that, and manage that contract process, and then has been very active in the discussions leading to the selection of Ian, including the work with the recruiter that we used. So she's just done a marvelous job, and really appreciate everything that she's done to get us to this point.
Commissioner Smith, I'd like to just take a minute to say, Alex, thanks for stepping into the breach and, you know, filling in where you needed to fill in and did a really effective job of doing so. And Ian, welcome to the organization. Appreciate the comments on the organization's culture, and I appreciate Kelly's ability to put together a process. I think all of us who have had professional opportunities have gone through interviews where you realize the people asking the question didn't have enough background information to ferret out who was probably the best candidate. And so Kelly's design and process led us into you. And that process, I think, has yielded for the PUD an excellent choice. And welcome aboard. Glad you're here. Alex, again, thanks for your efforts. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Any other commissioner in comments? Thank both of you. And
okay, Commissioner Smith, I'd like to squeeze in one more manager item. I think we've got time to do this before noon. I want to ask Tracy Hunt to give a report. We've been very active supporting the COVID-19 vaccine efforts. I'd like to ask him to share with you what we've been involved in.
Okay, good morning. So starting last Monday, we began coordinating with the Town Toyota Center Vaccination Command Team. And starting on Tuesday, around 100 vaccines, ramped up to about 400, and then ended the week with about 700 vaccines. Today, they're planning about 707 more. And it's Monday through Friday, and they're getting ready to try to be ready to move into Saturday as well. So it's taken a whole team from the community. We have Confluence Health, Sean Douglas Health District, National Guard, Sheriff's Office, Washington State Patrol, Chelan County Search and Rescue volunteers, other volunteers, and also the PUD. So things that we have been helping on have a couple of categories here. Communications. Right now, they're using some, I'll say, search and rescue handheld devices that are going to be going away this week. So our tech shop worked to round up 25 radios to replace those emergency radios that are going to be leaving the site. We provided training to the communications lead today and handed off the radios and all of the chargers and batteries and everything else. So that stepped in and helped them out a great deal. Logistical support, we have two security personnel manning entrances and six additional parking lot attendants. For those of you that have been there or seen it, you basically drive in and get to see most of all of the parking area through different stages of the vaccination process. And so there's temperature checking, there's check-in, there's waiting area. And so there are several, I'll call them parking lot attendants, flaggers, and we're helping by providing six additional parking lot attendants. We're also working with the communications lead to be ready for expanded Wi-Fi performance. As this vaccination center continues on, they anticipate the need for better Wi-Fi capabilities, and so our fiber group is helping with that. They're stretched thin, and everybody's trying to do the right thing, and in almost all cases, they are. But sometimes people get out ahead of themselves, and so I was out on the site and noticed a couple of situations like extension cords running through puddles, and it made me think that who's helping them with safety. So we addressed the immediate safety issues, but then our safety group came out and performed a site walkthrough. You have a bunch of people doing a lot of things, people in the parking lots, all kinds of different groups. And so our safety folks did a walkthrough with recommendations, and literally the next day they made those adjustments. We had the snow day last week, and right before opening, they had the Toyota T100 pickup out there with a plow and a parking area. So we called building maintenance, and I bet 20, 25 minutes later we had two PUD snow plows in the parking lot just in time to clear the site so that they could initiate the vaccination start. They also have all kinds of things like temporary tents, and so getting ready for wind, we delivered sandbags. So just there are a number of things all coming together, and the ability to step out there and help this effort with all the resources the PUD has, I think has really made a sizable difference. And I know it's really been recognized by the site operations commander, Norby Johnson, and very, very much appreciated, and he wanted to pass that along to you all. So I also want to mention there hasn't been a phone call that I've made that hasn't been instantly responded to. Building maintenance, procurement, tech shop, human resources, security, fiber, safety, HPI, and communications. Everybody is stepping up and helping this community vaccination program. So anybody have any questions?
No question, Tracy, but it really makes me proud to hear what we're doing for our community. That's great.
I would like to call out Tracy. He's done a tremendous job. I mean, he's just been all over this from the beginning and making sure that he's available and understanding what's going on and thinking about what resources that we might have available to be able to support them. For example, who would have thought that radios would be an issue? And fortunately, we had surplus radios that we were able to bring to bear. So he's just done a great job of engaging and helping wherever he can. I would like to also say that, I'm sorry, Tracy, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's it.
I would like to also say that, you know, there are some costs associated with this, and we're trying to keep track of what those costs are. These will count as public power benefit costs, as we've done with our other COVID-19 support activities, because this vaccine effort could go on for a long time, and we expect that it's unlikely that PUDs are supporting the vaccination efforts in other part of the state. Therefore, there's some other way that these functions are being carried out. We have begun to deliver a message to CDHD and others that we're here to help with this transition period, but we really expect and hope that they will come up with the resources to be able to support this on their own. We assume that there must be federal or state dollars that are supporting these activities. So hoping that we can transition away from this and that they'll be able to operate on their own over the course of what is projected to be a six-month or more effort.
Commissioner Smith, I'd like to say something, if I may.
You bet.
And Steve, yeah, I'm going to get really on the topic you were just discussing, and that is wondering how other vaccination sites across the state are able to function if they do not have a resource similar to Chelan County PUD that is willing to lend a hand. And I want to echo what President Smith's comments were in terms of feeling a great deal of pride knowing that our organization, with the resources that we have available and with the someone spearheading like Tracy, who has the vision, who can get out ahead of problems and see problems before they appear, and understands what the resources are the district has, is able to bring great value to this effort, this global effort, really. So, Tracy, thank you so much for what you're doing. Really appreciate it in a very significant way. And, Steve, to you, I want to thank you for being a visionary and having the desire and the willingness to step out and help the community. I appreciate that a great deal as well.
Well, we felt like we had very clear direction from the gather that information.
Yeah, so I'm meeting with the health district and the operations lead tomorrow, and this is going to be part of what we're discussing, how it's happening in other places, and also to begin a transition in collaboration with the Town Toyota Center and the staffing opportunities they can bring, as well as how we just work over the next couple weeks to make it a smooth transition so they can continue to administer vaccinations.
Thank you again, Tracy and Steve and everybody else that's been involved.
Commissioners, with that, we've hit just a couple of minutes past noon. I would suggest that we stop here and pick back up at 1 o'clock.
So at this time, then, just a reminder for those that I won't be in the afternoon, and Steve McKenna will be chairing the meeting. It's time for us to recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock for the business session.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve McKenna. I'm filling in for our President Randy Smith. Welcome to our business session this afternoon. As we welcome the public for their input and participation in our meeting. And I would just at this time, with COVID and being on the internet for a meeting, I'd like to just open it up. Do we have any community members that would like to address the board or any items on the board this afternoon? Or items on the agenda? Okay, well, with that not said, we'll continue with our agenda, and then if during the meeting you have anything you would like to share, if you could just do the wave on the technology to let us know you'd like to speak, and we will ask you to keep your comments to 3 minutes. Address us by sharing your name and address with us. And we will give you that opportunity. So, again, welcome this afternoon. Steve, I'd like to begin with, we have our consent agenda. I don't believe we haven't voted on that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, commissioners, would someone like to make a motion to accept the consent agenda?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move we accept the consent agenda as prepared.
Second.
Just a Second. Quick.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Just a quick thought that we just want to note that agenda item 11 was
11.
Was moved as, to the consent agenda.
Correct. Thank you for that.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, Steve, we'll move right into the resolutions with item number 12.
Okay, we're going to do 12, 13, and 14 together, so I'll read them all. Number 12 is a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 1 and 2 and authorizing the issuance of a guaranteed maximum price GMP, amendment number 2 to Absher Construction Company of Puyallup, Washington, to provide building construction to the general contractor construction manager, GCCM Services, contract number 18-91 for the service center project. Agenda item 13 is a resolution authorizing amendment number 16 to services agreement SATA number 15-151 with TCF Architecture, PLLC, to provide long-term strategic facilities plan. And Agenda 14 is a resolution authorizing Amendment Number 4 to Services Agreement SA Number 19-10572 with Keithley Barber Associates Incorporated to provide commissioning services. Recall, commissioners, that we did provide a presentation on all these resolutions at the last board meeting. So today be fairly short review of where we stand, and then we'll be turning it over to you. Great. With that, I'll go with ask David Lodge to pick up the ball.
Thank you. So great review, Steve. So we're here to present the three resolutions to start the service center construction. And we visited the board many times on this project, but this is one of the big moments. So approval of these resolutions will launch building construction and lead to move-in starting at the end of 2022 and early into 23. So this was no small feat to get to this point. This is the result of years of design work, pre-construction planning, stakeholder meetings, some heated arguments, and constant focus on creating value. What this process has taught us is that we are presenting the right team for this project. So the first resolution with Absher Construction. The first thing we're asking to do is to ratify two change orders and issuing the GMP amendment for the balance of the construction project. So as you recall, contract 1891 was awarded to Absher in 2019 for pre-construction services. And then last summer, in August, we added GMP 1 for $9.5 million. And since that time, we've had two change orders related to underground utility conflicts, unforeseen conditions, and some owner-directed changes. So this resolution ratifies those two change orders and then adds guaranteed maximum price 2 in the amount of $95,132,983. And this brings the total contract cost to $104,799,506. So just a reminder, the GMP contract is still subject to change orders, which is why the project is carrying construction contingency outside of the contract amount. And change order approval is subject to delegated authority. So the team intends to be back to the board periodically to provide updates and to ratify changes periodically. So would you like me to keep going or any questions on that resolution? I'll just run through them all.
Okay.
So the second is increasing the service agreement with TCF Architecture. So TCF has been our partner all the way through this, and this resolution will add $2 million to their service agreement, increasing the total not-to-exceed amount to $22,688,000 in order to contract for construction administration services. And these services are vital to maintaining continuity of the design team, ensuring the project is constructed in line with the design intent. And finally, the last resolution is for increasing service agreement with Keithley Barber Associates by $350,000 for a revised not-to-exceed amount of $610,000. This will allow the Service Center project to contract for commissioning agent services. And Keithley Barber was used on Rock Island and is currently working on Rocky Reach and has been found to provide significant value. They were also used heavily during design on the Service Center for design review and is ready to support the construction and startup process for this project. So all three of these resolutions allow for contract spending in line with the approved project budget. And we've been working for some time with this team, and we are confident that we are presenting the right team and we're on the right path to project success and creating long-term value for our customer owners. Any questions on these three resolutions?
David, just for a matter of information for anybody in the public that's listening to this, do a quick review of what a commissioning agent is. I know what they're doing, but could you share the importance of why this is important to our public?
Absolutely. So each contractor that's working on the project is responsible for their own startup of each of the components that they're providing. So the electrician starts up the electrical gear, and the mechanical contractor starts up all the HVAC equipment. But the commissioning agent is the one who really pulls it all together and makes sure that the system is operating in line with the design intent. So we've made tremendous efforts to design a very energy-efficient building, but only if all of the components are working together to achieve that goal. So Keithley Barber will be involved through all of construction, doing periodic reviews and checking over submittals and making sure that we're aligned with the documents, but also that the components work together. And then when it comes to startup, that's where they're very involved in making sure that each piece is operating the way it's intended to and operating as a system. And so at the end, the commissioning process is them making sure that it's all functioning and turning over the energy-efficient product that we are hoping to get.
I just appreciate it as, another, not only inspectors looking at it, but the commissioning agent making sure that the public is getting what they're paid for.
Absolutely.
Things are operating correctly. Commissioners, I think what I would do, this is the largest resolution I've ever asked to have approved, and it's a little breathtaking when you stop and think about it. I have never done anything this large, so Now I know why President Smith took leave of absence to this afternoon. So, commissioners, I think I would like to receive a motion on these three items and then open it up for any discussion before we vote. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Vice President, I move that we accept resolutions 12, 13, and 14 as presented.
Do I have a second?
I seconded that.
Okay, thank you, Gary. I just didn't hear that.
We have Steve, any discussion? All right, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Ann.
So this is our discussion phase, right?
Yes.
So I am trying to, I'm looking around now, I'm trying to get back to looking at that resolution. I didn't print them out beforehand, a hard copy. But I wanted to look at the second resolution, which would be resolution number 13, the additional $20 million. I have a question about that, just for my own, for anybody who's listening. Can you explain a little more about that and tell me if that was, not anticipated, was anticipated? Just help me with that, if you would.
Yeah, sure. For clarification, it was an additional $2 million for TCF architecture. and yes, no, it's okay. It brings the total to $22 million for their service agreement. But yes, it's a $2 million addition, and it was anticipated, and it's been in our budget all along. So,
that, you know what, David? That's all I need to know. I apologize for making you go back and look at it. $20 million stuck in my brain, and I can't bring it up. I don't have it in front of me right now. So, yeah, I was way off. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
Commissioners or public, do we have anybody else wishing to ask questions?
Commissioners, I would just like to add one comment that with these contracts, we will have more than three quarters of the total budget under contract. This is an important moment for us because it's an increasing level of confidence, our ability to deliver the project on the project budget. So very, very important moment, as Commissioner McKenna has identified, and important particularly with respect to our ability to be able to deliver the project that was originally intended.
All right. Well, with no other questions to this momentous action, let's take action on resolution number 12, 13, and 14. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Congratulations, David and team. We look forward to seeing this continue to move forward.
Yes, thank you, Commissioners.
Okay, Steve, on to item 15.
Okay, this is a resolution authorizing the General Manager to enter into a services agreement, SA number 20-10919, with Enhanced Telecommunications Incorporated, DBA ETI Software Solutions of Norcross, Georgia, for fiber portal replacement, implementation, and support. Kevin McKee is going to make this presentation.
Yep. Thanks, Steve. Hi, I'm presenting a resolution to enter into a service agreement with ETI Software Solutions for fiber portal replacement, implementation, and support. I want to give you a little background on the reason for our resolution. The fiber portal, what we call the fiber portal, it's a web-based database, and it has most of the core business processes for our fiber department. The portal was built in-house 15 years ago. And it's the primary interface for all of our retail service provider customers. It handles things like order provisioning, billing, provisioning, trouble ticketing. All of that is tied up into this web-based database. The system, it's aged in the past 15 years, and telecommunications management standards for software have been developed, and the current system's really at the end of life for both development and security purposes. Development on our system was stopped about 10 years ago, but industries continue to evolve, and right now the fiber portal is no longer meeting our needs. So we'd like to use the platform developed by ETI Software as a replacement for the fiber portal. It will be moving to a standards-based platform. The ETI portal is based on telecom management forum standards. TM Forum, it's an international organization, and they focus on standardizing processes between telecom companies. And the big goal is to automate telecom service provisioning and billing. And ETI Software was written as open access from the ground up. And as you know, that's how we operate with multiple service providers. And so this is designed to handle multiple retail service providers. It will standardize and streamline our business processes. And it will also automate provisioning and allow automation into outside service provider systems. This project, we're kind of halfway through. We had started doing analysis on this to figure out what our business processes actually were and figure out how they could be mapped into standard processes. We're now looking to get approval on the development and execution phases. The project will have a go-live date in the second quarter of 2021, and then we'll go into ongoing support after that. The big customer and service provider benefits are we expect to have instant provisioning for upgrades and resumption of service. Right now, you probably know that our broadband take rate in the county is about 50%, actually over 50%. So when a Chelan County resident moves into a new house, there's a really good chance that they've got fiber equipment already installed. With automated provisioning, when an ISP places an order, the service can be turned up before the customer hangs up the phone. If they want to upgrade, downgrade, that would happen while they're talking to their ISP. It also allows the ISPs to disconnect and then reconnect people as people are on the phone. Another thing that it improves is asset management. All of the equipment is tracked in the system down to the individual network port. So if there is a piece of equipment on somebody's house, each network port we keep track of as a separate asset, and it makes a much more efficient use of our assets and resources. We're also looking at evaluating advanced features. We're going to hopefully look at GIS integration, field services applications, and different ways that we can gain efficiencies and improvements by tying it into other databases and systems inside the district. The resolution is asking for an approval for a total amount of $1.9 million. This would include the initial configuration as well as 7 years of service and support. And we've included the ability to fund potential feature additions and integrations into these other district projects over the next 7 years. We are getting a reduced cost on the monthly support by entering into a 7-year contract. We believe this project will preserve the value and the reliability of our current district assets. As well, we really believe it will increase the value for our ISP partners and then their end users and ratepayers in the county.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. I have to tell you that as I was listening to you, it took me back years and years and years ago when the first fiber proposal was put out there that these glass fibers will last, but we are going to need to continue to update our equipment. And that's the great part of this, that we can continually reinvest and support that initial investment of that fiber cable. So you took me back a ways. Commissioners, any questions?
Kevin, this is Dennis. I have one question. So $1.9 million. Is it part of your current budget?
Yes, it is.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions for Kevin? Kevin, thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you.
So Steve. We can move on to item.
I thought, Kevin, you did a really good job of explaining what it is you're seeking and the benefits for doing so. So thank you.
Thank you.
Steve, item 16.
It's a resolution approving a request for qualifications number 20-44 for Rock Island Powerhouse 2 Motor Control Center Replacement Project and authorizing the general manager of the district to publish notice inviting sealed proposals for said project using the alternative design build procedure authorized by RCW 39.10.300 ET SEQ. With that, I'm going to ask Devin Myers to make this presentation.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks for taking the first paragraph out of my presentation here. My name is Devin Myers, and I'm a project manager down at Rock Island, where my main focus is Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation. I'm here today to inform you of another balance of plant project that we are initiating as part of the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation. This is the Powerhouse 2 unit motor control replacement project. Motor control centers replacement project. We call them MCCs. That's what I'm having. I'm tripping over some of the words using the whole name for it. A motor control center is equipment used to control electric motors in a centrifugation, and it consists of multiple enclosed sections or buckets having a common bus. The MCC buckets are made up of components like motor starters, relays, variable frequency drives, programmable logic controls or PLCs, and other components that control motor-based equipment like our cooling fan motors, unit unwatering pumps, or our governor pump motors. Okay, this project includes replacing all of the unit MCCs, including relocating the unit governor MCCs from the 504 elevation to the 573 elevation and putting them all in one location. This will remove the governor MCCs from a wet environment and improve maintainability of the whole system. We'll also be using this as an opportunity to upgrade to more modern MCC technology, which can include arc flash protection, PLCs, and networking capabilities. So I'm going to kind of pause there for a question if anybody has any questions regarding what the project is. Okay. Jump in if you have any questions as I go through this anytime. Okay, so as Steve mentioned, we are planning on using an alternative procurement method known as design build, allowed under Washington State RCW 3910. To meet the design build requirements of RCW 3910.300, the project is required to be over $2 million and meet one of the following criteria. The following three criteria. This project happens to meet all the criteria, and the criteria are as follows. Construction activities are highly specialized, and a design build approach is critical to developing a construction methodology. Okay, with this existing governor MCCs are in a wet environment, and so specialized design build approach is needed to determine whether MCCs should be relocated or redesigned to meet the wet conditions. Second criteria, the project selected provides an opportunity for greater innovation or efficiencies between designer and builder. This one we have a few bullet points. The new MCCs are to have arc flash mitigation, which each manufacturer has kind of their own way of doing that, so we'll have an opportunity to look at those. Design build will allow the contractor to propose innovative networking solutions that best meet the district's operations and maintenance requirements. And the design build will also allow greater innovation in design as service in wet conditions considered along with required arc flash mitigation. So it allows for greater efficiency in relocation versus redesign as factored into the overall construction methodology and or project schedule. And the final criteria is significant savings in project delivery time would be realized. And so we feel this one is met by the design build would allow the contractor team that is responsible for and coordinates the design, MCC supply, and installation to keep the project on schedule. because they're responsible for all aspects of that project. Okay. So this kind of explanation of the progressive design build method. So we've actually done this. This will be the fourth time we've done this at the district. And so the district, the way this works is we'll start off by issuing a request for qualifications to determine a short list of up to 4 qualified proposers. The district then issues a request for proposal to the shortlisted contractors, and then they will put in a proposal, and the proposal provides the following information. Now, their recommended approach to the project, which includes scope, schedule, MCC supply, installation plans, site and safety management, up to a 50% technical design, safety by design proposed enhancements, and as well as a guaranteed maximum price based on the current technical design and recommended approach. The district will evaluate these RFPs and select the most qualified design builder to enter into negotiations for a design build agreement, at which time we will come back to the board to try to execute a design build agreement. And once we've actually executed a design build agreement, an honorarium in the range of $10,000 to $15,000 will be paid to all the contractors for their efforts in preparing a responsive proposal. Okay. Any questions then? All right.
Commissioners, any questions?
Okay. I'll wrap it up then. So we're seeking authorization to submit an application to present our proposal to the state PRC and advertise an RFQ after we receive state approval for the alternative procurement method for the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 unit MCC replacement projects. To accomplish this, we'll be seeking approval from the State Capital Project Advisory Review Board, CPARB, in March 25th, and contingent on that approval, we would like to issue our RFQ by mid-April.
Very good.
Okay.
Devin, thank you very much for the overview.
You bet. Thank you.
Do we have any other further questions? Steve, let's go ahead and move into item 17.
Okay, this is a resolution approving the agreement reached pursuant to labor negotiations with Local Number 77 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers for the period April 1st, 2021 through March 31st, 2022. Lorna Kolmansky will be presenting.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I just would like to introduce this and to say that the union membership has ratified the tentative agreement we reached back on January 8th. I'm now recommending board ratification of that one-year agreement. For ongoing wages, we ended up at just under $2.6 million per year increase. That was a 2.75% general wage increase and a 4.2% market adjustment for apprenticeable crafts. We agreed also to a one-time contribution of $600 to HRA VEBA accounts for benefit eligible employees who will be currently employed on the date of board ratification, which I hope is today. And that will include our estimate at this time is 373 employees for a total of $223,800. That is a one-time only cost. And then on 4-1, our top staff journeyman lineman rate will be $51 an hour. So I would at this time like to ask for your approval to ratify that agreement. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioners, do we have any questions for Lorna?
I have just a question only because the sound garbled, Lorna, and I lost what you'd said. Was that 61 an hour or 51 an hour?
51, 5-1.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions, commissioners? Lorna, thank you very much. Thank you for the good work. I'm glad somebody else is negotiating. I've done enough of that in my life, and glad you're there. So thank you very much for your work and your staff. Please pass that on to the negotiating team.
Thank you. I will. It was challenging to do in a virtual environment.
I bet. Commissioners, we have item 15, 16, and 17. I would be happy to take a motion on all three of those items if you so move.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of resolutions 15, 16, and 17 as presented.
Second.
And seconded by Dennis. Do we have any other discussion on the items? I'll call for a vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion passes. Steve, we will move into manager. I think we have an additional manager item left over from this morning. We'll start with that.
Yeah, I want to invite Aline Underwood to give an update on a presentation she'll be making at Northwest Power and Conservation Council soon.
Thanks, Steve. So, good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Aline Underwood, Manager of Fish and Wildlife. So I wanted to let you know that we're presenting to the full Power Council on February 10th, and I won't be making the presentation, but there's staff from our organization along with Douglas and Grant County PUDs, and we're doing this presentation really for two reasons. The first of which is there's a new executive director for the Power Council that we've actually recently met. There's a new Fish and Wildlife Director there. There's also going to be a new, I think he or she has been elected, but a new council member from Montana. So we think that it's a really good idea to present to the full council, not even just the Fish and Wildlife portion of the council, a lot of the data that we've been collecting and implementation of our HCPs, as well as the settlement agreements for grants. So again, this is a three PUD presentation. Most of the data that's going to be presented is the same information we presented to the board before. In various forms or fashions, we're really focusing on educating the council on our three areas, including obviously habitat, hatcheries, and hydro survival. So the second reason we want to go and present to the council at this particular time is last fall, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife presented data to the council that we believe, and we collectively, the three PUDs, misconstrue survival of adult spring Chinook, specifically in the upper basin of the Columbia River. So they used a model, a new model, to show that survival of those fish in the upper basin, specifically the Methouse Spring Chinook, was less than in the lower river, and they made the conjecture that it could be because those fish passed two more dams than their lower river counterpart. So while we acknowledge that all models can have their limitations, we certainly posit that there are stark errors in their particular model and that the model doesn't correct for several things. So all good models need to have a list of variables they correct for. And the ones predominantly that DFW neglected to include here specifically are there are some adult fish that return, and we're really talking about from Bonneville upstream. There's some adult fish that return that stray into other basins. There's a lot of fish that are collected for broodstock collection programs for all three of our collective programs. As you can imagine, we all three have pretty robust hatchery programs. So those fish were not taken out of the number of fish that were allowed to count as survived to the upper basin. And then finally, the model fails to consider the effects of harvest. And we're talking about both tribal zone 6 fishery harvest as well as from predators. So, you know, models often assume harvest is insignificant and stable from year to year. But I thought I'd share a couple of interesting facts that you may or may not be aware of, is that we know that harvest is about 18% from the tribal fisheries. So this is really from Bonneville to McNary Dam, we figure roughly 18% of fish destined for the upper river are actually incidentally captured in tribal harvest. Secondarily, with respect to pinnipeds, a new study has concluded that in years when sea lions are abundant at the Clovey River mouth, an additional 21% of early arriving Chinook, which our spring Chinook that come to the top of the basin are the most early arriving Chinook, were an additional 21% of those fish, which is 1 in 5, were likely consumed by those predators compared to prior years. So, frankly, this also ties into all the work that we've been doing regionally to work with our partners and stakeholders to have pinniped removal programs and better understand the effects of predation in the lower river as they do impact us up here in the river. So really what we're attempting to do through our presentation is to offer the council a different set of facts that we see up here, that not only are these numbers and data that we're using to evaluate our own programs, but our stakeholders are using and buying off on all of our programs. Obviously, our stakeholders being DFW, the tribes, and other federal entities. So wanted to give you a heads up about that, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Yeah, Aline, this is Ann.
Hi.
I'm kind of astounded. Those seem like glaring glaring mistakes, glaring omissions. How can you explain that? Are they not doing their research? I know you probably don't want to say anything negative, but to me, it looks like really shoddy work, to be frank.
Yeah, so I would say that, again, back to the point that there's different ways to use different models. We can't possibly know the impetus behind why this particular model was updated, or why the results were presented as they were. All we can tell you is that using similar models with a broader set of variables accounted for, we think that it draws attention to the flaws of that particular model that the state is using.
Well, good for you and your team and for paying attention and doing the research and, you know, being on top of this and responding and monitoring and, yeah, good work. I'll be anxious to hear where this goes.
Yes, so will we. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Commissioner Arsenault, and I actually have a question. I want to make sure that I have the numbers correct in my head, and that is that between the tribal take and also predators, the returning salmon, we're looking at over a 40% reduction just from those two things?
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Yes.
Arlene, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to hearing from you after your... Now, this is a presentation that you'll make?
Yes, folks are making this presentation to the Power Council on February 10th. We don't have the exact time slot yet, but once we know, I'll pass that on to folks so they can listen in if you're interested.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Steve, do we have any other additional commissioner or manager items?
We do not.
All right. So we'll move into item number 19, commission items. We have a tri-commission meeting coming up. Do I have a motion?
I'd like to make a motion to set a special meeting on Tuesday, March 30, 2021 at 1 p.m. to be held virtually for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting. Virtual meeting information will be posted on the PUD website.
I'll second the motion.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Against? Motion passes. Commissioners, do we have any other items from you?
Steve, this is Ann. I just want to pass on some really nice positive comments from Mary Murphy. Mary is from Chelan. She is on the hospital board of directors. She's a health professional. She does a lot of training and in the health area, health profession. I think she's a PhD, so she's, you know, she's a really smart, well-trained lady. Anyway, she had some really nice, she called me and had some really positive, nice comments to make about the PUD and our efforts, our outreach, our efforts, our assistance to our, you know, our low-income folks in terms of paying their bills throughout this whole COVID pandemic. So I just told her I would share these comments with you all. I certainly can't phrase them the way she did. I can't, you know, I can't remember all the positive comments, but it was wonderful to hear.
Nice to have that feedback.
Yes.
All right. Commissioners, anything else? Okay, with that said, Lisa Sanders, Commissioner Travel. There's been a lot of it lately.
Yeah, you are all continuing to travel all over in your homes.
Yeah.
So we don't have much more than we had last time. The February WAPUTA meetings don't need to be registered for. The March APPA legislative rally, I have Commissioner Smith registered for. Commissioner Bowles and Commissioner Congdon said they won't be participating. So I'd like to check with Commissioners Congdon and Arsenault to see if you would like to be registered.
Yes, Lisa, please register me for that, if you would.
Okay. Commissioner McKenna?
Yes, please. Okay. Anything else?
Do you want me to book rooms for the June APPA conference in Chicago? Do you want to go that far?
Wow. Lisa, this is Gary, and I'm a little concerned at this point with respect to COVID to commit to travel that we might have to cancel. So I personally would like to get a little closer to June before I answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wasn't sure about comfort level with COVID or availability of rooms and that sort of thing. So I did want to touch base on that.
And Lisa, one other question, if I may. Do we know when the enrollment period is on that? You know, I know that typically the way that APPA has done it is to step up in price the closer you get to the conference. But could you just maybe alert us before the price increases just to see if our comfort level has increased enough to go ahead and sign up?
Yeah, I'll check that and get that on the calendar.
Thank you.
Does anyone else feel differently?
No, I agree with Gary.
Okay. So it looks like then we'll, I will register Commissioners Arsenault and McKenna for the APPA Legislative Rally, and we'll wait and see if the next few WAPUTA meetings need to be registered for or not. Sounded like we'll only need to register if there's voting. Does that sound like what they're doing?
You're referring to WAPUTA, Lisa?
Uh-huh. Yes.
I think they like to get a head count as to who's going to be in attendance. You certainly can put me down for February and again in March if you wish.
Okay.
And I as well, Steve.
Okay.
Yeah, February and March for Dennis.
Oh, this is Ann.
Hello.
Lisa.
Yes. Hello?
You're not coming through, Ann.
Yeah, I don't know. Something's haywire with my mute and on
now I can hear it.
Button. Lisa, I will let you know soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Is there anything else that you want to bring to my attention or that I've missed that you want to look ahead to? Are we good?
Lisa, I'd good. Like, to book, I'd like to book a flight to Greece, but I don't think that's in the cards these days.
France. Tell them France.
How about Dubai?
Anywhere would work.
Okay, this is deteriorating quickly, so we're going to move on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Steve, do we have any delegation of action items from our previous board meeting?
We just had one. There was a request for the communications team to work to help facilitate the civility and public service outreach plan. Honestly, we came up with some things, and Commissioner Smith was so on top of it, he was already out in front of what we had, were going to propose. I checked in with him. He was fine with proceeding without our support, at least at this time. So that one is now taken care of.
Great. Thank you.
And I did want to just mention that we did have a long due item that Rhonda closed out this morning, and it had to do with Commissioner McKenna's question when we had presented the original investigation of the fatality and our follow-up action item. So we've now taken care of that one as well.
Do we have any delegation of items from this meeting?
Yeah, we have a couple. We've got a follow-up that Tracy Yount will provide information on how vaccine distribution centers are being supported in other areas. And Janelle will share information on limitation of the depth chart, how we do that collect by boat. So, we'll get that for Commissioner Congdon.
Great. Thank you very much. At this point, are there any additional comments from the public? Hearing none, do we have any other matters of general business as may necessarily come up before this commission today? Hearing none, we will be moving into executive session. Eric, do I need to?
Do we have one?
No.
Yeah.
Does this change?
Yeah, Commissioner, I don't think we actually have any executive session items today with the rescheduling of one.
I thought we still had one. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Looks like we're all finished. Steve, am I missing anything?
You are not. I think we've covered everything.
All right. I will call the meeting to close. Have a great day.
Thank you.